Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, you're going to hear about the mystery of students absent from American schools. We have the story of Mary Britton, the daughter of freed slaves, who went on to become Lexington's first female doctor. And in the second half of this week's show, we'll tell you how you can get involved in the making of an episode of Eastern Standard. We have Bea Taylor on how she's blended her music with film, ballet, and orchestra, and C.J. Lewandowski on the making of an album in tribute to and featuring bluegrass legend Bobby Osborne, recorded only months before his passing. First, the science around autism has evolved rapidly only in recent decades. Thousands of highly trained researchers and clinicians have generated an extraordinary amount of information about autism's genetics and neurobiology. They've come up with reliable early detection methods, special education's been expanded, and there are improved behavioral and medical therapies. The condition was thrust back into the news recently when President Trump claimed, without evidence, that taking acetaminophen, Tylenol, during pregnancy is linked to a child's risk of autism, that scientists and doctors have failed to prevent an epidemic, and that his administration would virtually eliminate autism, which he called a horrible crisis. Well, what is true here? Joining us is Amanda Ralston, a Lexington-based thought leader in the autism care and behavioral health industries with over 25 years of experience as a behavior analyst, and she's the founder and CEO of Non-Binary Solutions. Thanks for joining us, Mandy.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to see you again.
And we'll get back to the president's recent remarks later on, but I want to start with what we know about autism. You pointed out to me that autism is not monolithic. In fact, researchers now believe that searching for a single cause of autism is misguided, that there are autisms rather than just autism. So let's begin there. What can you tell us?
Autism is a very heterogeneous group of people. There's a common saying amongst families that if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's been sort of my life's work is understanding that there are very significant behavioral phenotypes, multiples of them within this conglomeration of a diagnosis called autism. So people talk about autism now as a spectrum, but I think we were also talking about spectrums. I think the first spectrum that comes to mind for people is generally the severity of one's autism. And so there's levels 1, 2, and 3 now as diagnostic criteria, but that really doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of the multitude of individuals and the multitude of traits and spectrums that we're actually dealing with within autism.
Is it possible that what might seem like an epidemic, quote unquote, to some might actually be the result of a greater awareness and changing definitions?
Yeah, I've been doing a talk about this for a couple of years now. And for those of you that are interested, there's a white paper on the website for Non-Binary Solutions sort of talking about what's going on with the rate of diagnosis over the last 20 years. And it's a flywheel of things. Hashtag it's not binary. There's more than one thing happening here. So there is greater awareness. There is less stigma at this point, and therefore physicians are more willing to give the diagnosis. Also, we have mandated insurance coverage in all 50 states now. There are actual services and providers. We've had a 500% increase in providers in the last 10 years. Side note, over half of those providers have less than 3 years of experience, but that's a different talk show. We'll do that some other time. And so, yeah, you know, there's multiple things happening that are actually driving the rate of diagnosis up. So just for some background, when the DSM-3, that's the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, that's the classification of mental disorders through the APA, when that third version came out in 1980, that was the first time in history that autism and childhood schizophrenia were separated as diagnoses. So you can understand just from that data point alone that there was a stigma attached with actually giving a child a diagnosis of autism. And so if your physician was in medical school or trained and graduated anywhere around that period of time, that's the information that they likely carried with them. Now, by the time you get to 1994, when the DSM-4 is released, then we have 5 different diagnostic codes. We have autism, pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, childhood disintegrative disorder, Rett's disorder, and something called Asperger's syndrome, right? Now, at that point, we also get the internet started in 1995, right? And so in 1995, 3% of Americans had logged on to something called the World Wide Web. And the rate of diagnosis for autism was about one in every 1,000 individuals at that point. Flash forward 5 years later to 2000, the rate of diagnosis, historically looking back from the CDC data, shows that autism was one in every 150 individuals. Also, notably, regarding the adoption of technology, at that point, 80% of Americans had now downloaded music. So you can see that people are starting to adopt this new technology. And so families are finding each other. It's the information era, right? And they're saying, hey, your son sounds like my son. What do you mean your son has autism? What is that? And they're saying, well, what are you doing? What is this therapy that you're doing with them? Applied behavior analysis. What is that? And wait a minute. What do you mean Indiana has a mandated insurance coverage for this, that they don't have to pay out of pocket for these services? What is that? So the very grassroots movement starts happening, and the parents are sharing information, and they're forcing legislature to be passed. And it's driving services. You know, people are saying, hey, we see a demand for more providers in this place. So there's a lot going on that's actually driving those rates up over time.
So instead of there being an explosion of cases, the internet kind of pulled back the curtain on what was already there.
That's right.
You mentioned Asperger's. It's a term that has come and gone. Tell us about that. Why is that?
There's a multitude of factors here. So Hans Asperger was the first person, I think, to note this condition back in 1944. He was a German medical researcher. I think later some of his research came to light with a woman named Lorna Wing, who was a British medical researcher, and she started to coin the term Asperger's syndrome around 1992, 1994. So that's how it sort of got into the DSM-IV at that point. But later in 2013, when the DSM-5 came out, they took away all of those other classifications that we talked about. So what used to be PDD, NOS, or pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, and the Asperger's syndrome all got lumped into one diagnostic code of autism spectrum disorder. There's a few reasons that Asperger's was removed. Part of it was a controversy related to Asperger's. Hans Asperger's himself was related to some Nazi affiliations. But overall, individuals felt that possibly the diagnosis was better related as a spectrum disorder. So it's not without controversy. A lot of people miss that diagnosis.
And there's that word again. You touched on it earlier, spectrum. We hear often the phrase on the spectrum referring to somebody who's been diagnosed with a form of autism. How broad is that spectrum?
Yeah, well, the diagnostic threshold for any condition in the DSM-5 is the degree to which it impairs your day-to-day functioning, right? So all of the diagnostic traits and symptoms within autism and some other neurodivergent conditions, ADHD, OCD, et cetera, you might see those traits in people that do not have the diagnosis. So again, it's the degree to which it actually impedes your day-to-day functioning, whether it meets a diagnostic threshold, which is why, you know, you can find plenty of people out there on TikTok that are quote-unquote self-diagnosed. I'd like to sort of address that you can't self-diagnose. You might self-identify, but, you know, you actually have to go see a medical, psychological professional in order to achieve a diagnosis.
I came across a letter to the editor in the Washington Post. It was from the head of a San Diego clinic, himself, self-described as autistic. And he notes that, quote, language that treats autism as an epidemic is damaging to autistic individuals because it implies we're broken and need to be cured. But isn't it true that this spectrum includes people who are nonverbal, have severe challenges like seizures, have intellectual disabilities, engage in self-injury maybe, and require intensive support? That's somewhere on that spectrum.
Absolutely. So first of all, I try to spread this message as much as possible. You know, there's a lot of individuals that are diagnosed on the spectrum or identify as being on the spectrum that are fierce self-advocates. And I say, good for you guys. I'm happy to hear you advocating for yourselves. But what I also like to preach is just because you share a diagnosis with a group of people does not mean you get to speak for the whole group. You get to advocate for yourself. And yes, this is a very, very heterogeneous group of people. And so you've got those levels 1, 2, and 3. Level 3 being the more profoundly affected individuals, they will need significant supports for the bulk of their lives. They may have minimal to no communication skills. They may have damaging self-injurious behavior. They may need lifelong supports to live independently or otherwise. And that's about 25% of individuals diagnosed with autism. The level two, sort of the mid-level support need individuals, make up about 25 to 30% of individuals diagnosed with autism. And the level one, which are considered the quote-unquote more high-functioning, if you will, individuals that need minor supports or limited supports make up about 40 to 50% of those individuals. So, yeah, it really does encapsulate a large group of people, anywhere from individuals that have those profound needs all the way to the other end of the quote-unquote spectrum, which may include the guy that gets called into HR on a regular basis because he's perceived as being rude.
Just to put a fine point on it, at that other end of the spectrum, the highly functioning spectrum, are people who work at the highest levels of like academia, government, technology, mild autistic features that actually help them succeed in their professions.
Yeah. I mean, again, autism through a lens of a medical model that, you know, we have to operate in somewhat in order to provide services as providers, you know, and to get reimbursement from insurance companies, et cetera. You know, the medical model tends to pathologize the symptoms of autism and want to fix or improve or mitigate or ameliorate the symptoms, right? But at the same time, you know, it's two sides of the same coin. Some of the features and symptoms, if you will, of autism have great benefits, whether that's the ability to hyperfocus, to be able to operate in noisy sensory experiences, or to have a great deal of attention to detail. All of these things could be things that actually benefit your ability to work in certain environments.
Well, words matter. And when we describe people with autism as quote unquote casualties of a medicine or a vaccine, are we reinforcing a stereotype that people with autism are damaged and that this damage could have been prevented?
So, yeah, I mean, describing people with autism as casualties reinforces a damaging stereotype that these people are broken or damaged somehow. You know, these are not people that need to be fixed or cured. It really undermines the perspective of neurodiversity, which views autism as a natural variation in the human neurology rather than some kind of disease or condition to be fixed.
Just a question of logic here. If autism is, as some say, artificially induced by, say, Tylenol, as opposed to something genetic, why aren't we hearing about people who go from being neurotypical or quote-unquote normal to being autistic at some point in their lives?
Again, I think that that's a dangerous rhetoric. I think that's a harmful narrative to try to sell to people that this is something to be switched on and off at a genetic level or at an environmental level, either way, right? Again, this is a natural variation in human neurology. And the goal for every individual with autism or otherwise is to have the maximum quality of life that they can have, the most freedom and independence and ability to be happy and enjoy things that they enjoy. So yeah, I don't think we're going to see that a lot.
Well, Mandy, I've seen it suggested that for many people, autism shouldn't be considered a disorder or a disability at all, but instead a different way of being human. Your thoughts on that?
It's not binary. Again, I think both things can be true and valid at the same time, right? I think that there are individuals that will need assistance and treatment throughout their lives. I think there are also people that view their brain variation, their neurology variation as something to be celebrated. And I think it's really, again, up to the individuals and the families to decide where that line is for themselves.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, this is a huge subject. The subject itself is a spectrum. So I think we need to revisit it from time to time, if you'd be so kind to come in and talk to us about it.
I'm sure we'll find plenty to talk about going forward, yes.
All right. Amanda Ralston, founder of Non-Binary Solutions in Lexington. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
During the pandemic, we heard stories about kids falling behind in school, but a new Brookings report says the crisis went deeper than that. Millions of children simply disappeared from classrooms. They weren't in public school, They weren't in private school or even being homeschooled. Today, more than 2 million kids nationwide, and that includes Kentucky, are still missing from enrollment records. Education contributor Bridget Blom and her guests take up some urgent questions. Where do these students go, and what does it mean for our schools and our communities?
To help us unpack this, we're joined by Jill Barchet. Jill writes the weekly Proof Points column for the Hechinger Report, where she covers education research and data from early childhood through higher ed. She's taught algebra, reported for outlets like Marketplace, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, and The Financial Times. She's here to talk with us about her recent reporting on the missing kids of the pandemic era and what this could mean for Kentucky and the nation. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Jill.
Thank you for having me.
So your article describes this new generation of lost kids who simply aren't enrolled anywhere. They're not chronically absent because they're not enrolled. They're not showing up at all. From your reporting, what are some of the main reasons you're finding that kids have disappeared from the rolls?
It's a mystery. We don't understand why kids are missing or where they are. And frankly, it's possible that it's a statistical glitch in some way that we don't yet understand. The way researchers are calculating this is that they're looking at birth records. So we know how many kids there should be, ages 5 to 17, school age. And then they're able to piece together school records. They're looking at traditional public school records, charter school records, private schools, virtual schools, and kids who are homeschooled are supposed to be registered somewhere in some form. So when you subtract the enrollment records from the birth records, there's this big gap. And the gap first emerged at the beginning of the pandemic. And I, like many people, thought, well, you know, people move states and they weren't registered in schools yet in their new place. And I thought, oh, it'll really sort itself out. And a Stanford researcher at the end of 2023, he first really discovered these missing students. And then I thought it would still settle itself out. But now we have this Brookings report from this summer, and they still haven't found the students. It's not quite as high as it was at the beginning of the pandemic, but it's still over 2 million students, just like you said. And Kentucky, the state you're in, has one of the highest numbers. The records are a little bit more dated, but the highest state is Oregon, where there's 12% missing students. The average around the country is about 5.5%. In Kentucky, it's almost 8%.
You mentioned it could be a glitch, but this isn't brand new. As you mentioned, Stanford has looked at this. Brookings is looking at this. No one's uncovered, if it is a statistical glitch, where the glitch is. And Kentucky is just under 8%, as you shared. We're experiencing all of this as a nation at the same time we're grappling with chronic absenteeism nationwide. And internationally, there's been lots of talk about the demographic decline, the demographic drought, that there are not enough individuals being born to replace the adults to maintain the economy as we've designed it. So there's something of a perfect storm brewing when we look at attendance, enrollment in school, lost kids, demographic drought. What do you make of all of this as you look forward with your experience and base of reporting on so many issues relative to education and the economy?
Right. Women and men are not making as many babies as they used to. It started in the 2008 Great Recession. And that's not typical in a recession. People are worried about the future. They might not be feeling this is a good time to have children. But it just kept going and going. Women were just not making as many babies. And so you add 5 years after a drought in baby making, and then there's fewer kids to enroll in the school system. And now we've had about 17, 18 years of this birth drought. The Brookings researchers predict that if the birth rate continues as it is now, the lower birth rate, where the average woman is having about 1.7 babies over the course of their lifetime, compared to 2.1 would be the population replacement level, that we will have somewhere between 2 million and almost 9 million fewer students in the public schools by mid-century. So about 35 million students in the public schools in 2050. That's far less than we have now. You can't sustain the current number of schools with that few children. And we're expecting a massive number of school closures.
And so real implications for budgeting at the school level, for school closing, as you mentioned. So this will have ripple effects from a community standpoint, from an economic standpoint, and from an education standpoint.
Right. So in the short term, most schools' finances are based on how many students are in the school. They get a certain amount of funding per student. So if you have fewer students in your school each year, that means the principal's dealing with a smaller budget every year. But like you say, in the long term, it affects our economy. If you have fewer high school graduates, that's fewer people to go into the workforce, fewer people to go to college, and then fewer people to go to the workforce after college.
And in the reporting that Brookings did, these missing young people are predominantly from high poverty areas and Black communities. So when we look at generational poverty and breaking cycles of generational poverty, the kids that aren't showing up in school are the kids we may most want to make sure they're getting the education that will help them move forward successfully.
I'd like to clarify a bit. We do not know where the missing kids are. We do not know if they're from primarily low-income communities. We do not know if they're from Black communities. That's a separate part of the Brookings report, and where they're talking about where the greatest departure from traditional public schools are. So what we do know is low-income communities, one out of four students is not in a traditional public school. But we know that they may be in a charter school. They may be in a virtual school. They may be in a private school. And it was shocking for me that Black Americans have the lowest rate of traditional public school going. One out of three Black Americans is not at a traditional public school. Missing children don't necessarily explain where they are. We know where many of them are. Let me give you a more specific example. In Washington, D.C., and the state of Florida, and the state of Delaware, there are no missing children. The number of enrolled kids exactly matches the number of children that exist from birth records. And yet still, we can see in those low-income communities and those Black communities that they're not in traditional public schools. Okay. And that puts pressure on those public school budgets because, like I say, the schools are funded per student. And so if you have a low-income Black community, that means they're much more severely underfunded.
Yeah, important clarification there. And you mentioned an area of the country where the enrollment records and the birth records match currently. So there are not missing students. What can a state or even a local school district do right now to better understand the gap that Brookings is reporting, if it is actually a gap in enrollment? And if so, how can a local community respond to reach out to those families and young people?
I wish I knew how to find them. It's like finding something that you don't know where it exists exactly. It's like it's much easier to find the chocolate bars in your pantry that do exist. How do you find the chocolate bars that don't exist? And it's kind of maybe we need private eyes and investigative reporters to figure this out. Maybe there are kids in rural areas who are not even registered as homeschooling. We just don't know what's going on. And I really encourage journalists in your community to try to figure it out.
So in the area of the country where there isn't a gap currently, we don't really know what that community or that state has done differently, or if they've uncovered something that's resulted in there not being a gap in enrollment.
On some level, I think the urban places are much less likely to have a gap. I think it's interesting that this small state of Delaware and the District of Columbia, another small place, they have no gap. They understand where their students are. But it's also fascinating that Florida, a large state with many rural areas, it also has no gap. It's also known for having very good data in that state, and so it might have something to do with their administrative records. I was very surprised that Oregon had the largest gap, but it also has the state is full of large rural areas, and that might help explain it.
So I think back, Jill, to, you know, your teaching of algebra. You have intimate knowledge of the importance of education for young people. They're learning to read. They're learning to do mathematics. As a country, we've committed to an investment in education, that it's not optional. We've ensured everyone has access to an education. What does it make you think about when you think about a 450% increase in the number of kids who are just not showing up anywhere to be educated?
Well, I hope we can find them, and I hope we can figure out what's going on. My greatest hope is it's a statistical error. I think it's not. My second greatest hope is they're being homeschooled well, but for whatever reason, the families are not registering them. But maybe both are wishful thinking. I'm extremely concerned that many children are not getting a basic education. And how are we going to handle these children as they grow into adults? They're going to need an enormous amount of social services. I don't see how they'll be employable. I have many fears.
You're encouraging journalists, researchers, public policy, thought leaders in local states and communities to really look into the issue locally and at the state level. Are you aware of additional research that might be happening at the national level?
I know the Associated Press has had its eye on this issue. It partnered with Thomas D. That was the Stanford professor at the end of 2023. But in my reading of their coverage, it wasn't easy for them to find missing students either. We just need to keep looking.
Jill Barchet with the Hechinger Report. Thank you for joining us on Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me.
As Lexington is celebrating its 250 years of existence, we're visiting from time to time with Dr. Mandy Higgins, Executive Director of the Lexington History Museum, to learn about individuals in Lexington's past who have, in one way or another, made local history, but whose accomplishments may not be all that well known. This time, it's the story of Mary Britton.
Dr. Mary Britton was born in Kentucky to formerly enslaved parents right after the Civil War. She and her family were decently well-connected and well-educated. She had a sister who was a musician and a brother who was a pretty successful jockey. But her parents died pretty suddenly, and one right after the other, when she was about 15. And she had to decide what to do. So she's originally trained as an educator through the Methodist Church. And she taught in a number of schools. And then she realized that she wanted to do more. And so through her connection with the Methodist Church, she was educated in medicine and became the first licensed female doctor practicing in Lexington with a medical license, regardless of race. So she came back in 1902 and opened her home at 545 Fifth Street as a medical clinic, serving predominantly African-American Lexingtonians living in the East End. She was one of the most successful doctors in the city at the time. And Fayette County Public Schools has just honored her by naming a middle school after her.
So interesting that the first woman to practice medicine with a license in Lexington and have a school named after her was an African-American woman, the daughter of former slaves.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty incredible.
It's really incredible. In the museum, we have an image of her, a facsimile, so a copy of an image of her. Mm-hmm. She's the only woman in this image of African-American medical professionals who had met in the early 1900s. It's for like a, you know, like a precursor of the American Medical Association meeting. And she's the only woman, but she's doing a great job in Lexington. And her story had been known in history circles, but had sort of not circulated in the larger Lexington history for a very long time. So it's wonderful to see not only her getting recognition on the school building, but now hopefully students will be interested in her story and knowing more about the ways that she used education and medicine to really grow and work in the city.
Well, it's really great that you're bringing this out. That's Dr. Mandy Higgins, Executive Director of the Lexington History Museum. Thanks so much, Mandy.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we'd like to extend an invitation to you, and we'll have those details in a moment. Bea Taylor takes her music to film, ballet, and classical orchestra all in a month's time and right here in Lexington. And a tribute to bluegrass powerhouse Bobby Osborne.
This album, Keep On Keeping On, is kind of the last page of his story, and he literally played and sang almost all the way up to the end.
We'll be joined by C.J. Lewandowski, longtime friend of Osborne and co-producer of an album recorded with the bluegrass great only months before he passed away in 2023. That's all coming up next. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. We'd like to invite you to help us explore things that you want to know about here on Eastern Standard. Here's how you can do that. Use the Record app on your smartphone to record a question or tell us about a subject that you would like for us to look into, and then email that as an MP3 to es@eku.edu. Just type question in the subject line. We'll give you a heads up when it's going to be on the air and send you a link to the segment featuring your question at the top. This could be both fun and interesting. We hope you'll consider it.
History's made by the ones who are great, those we remember and those that we hate to leave behind. Oh, baby, you're one of a kind. When someone like me meets someone...
Bea Taylor may hail from Texas originally, but she's quickly become an adopted daughter of Kentucky. Not only for her music, but also for her willingness to involve Kentuckians in her expanding creative work. And we have a triple dose of these collaborations to run by her right now. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Bea.
Hi, Tom. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, too. And it seemed like eons ago, but when we talked back in February, near the very end of the conversation, I asked you about your plan to write music that you could perform with an orchestra, or at least an ensemble formed from an orchestra. And now here we are. It's 8 months later. And not only have you scored that music, you're getting ready to perform not only that music, but there's another collaboration happening even sooner than that. So let's begin with what's happening at Castle and Key Distillery on October 16th. I've seen the poster, Lexington Ballet featuring Bea Taylor. What's that about?
So they approached me and were like, hey, for this season of our ballet, you know, we'd like to be incorporating some more kind of outside artists. And they had heard some of my music previously, and it kind of just fell together quite quickly. In fact, it seemed like it moved very swiftly. And by the time I realized what was happening, there was a poster out that we're like, okay, we're doing this.
Are you performing with a full band?
It'll just be me solo.
Okay.
Yes, and I will be playing a few of my original songs that they have choreographed, put dance to. So talk about a kind of a bonus dream come true.
Yeah, no kidding. And then speaking of dreams coming true, just 8 days after that, you're going to be at the Downtown Arts Center here in Lexington. That's on October 24th, and this will involve strings from Lexville, the Lexington Philharmonic. So tell us about that.
So, yeah, as you know, we talked in February about some of, you know, my dreams being to have that happen, to be able to play with an orchestra and have my music actually in, you know, sight form and written down. And, you know, I truly believe that I'm a person that I write things down on a list. And that was one of the things that I wrote down. And I, you know, I always take a breath to make sure that I respect the universe and the things that sort of magically happen throughout this life. But I put hard work toward it. I put feet toward the things that I want to do as well. And I got to talking with Seth Murphy, who I love, local Lexington musician, and he's also heavily involved on the board with Lexville. And I told him about this dream I had of, you know, I don't know how I'm going to make it happen just yet, but I would really love to play my music involving an orchestra. And he said, well, I don't know right now if we can do the full thing, but what if, you know, how we kind of kicked this off and got started is we start off with a part of the string section. And so it has been a journey through this 8 months of me learning how to, you know, work with musicians who are in a union and renting an event space and the insurance and the emails and kind of the logistics of it. But it has been a really fun experience, and it's actually happening. That's that's the most exciting part for me all of this. And this is kind of a stepping stone, you know. It won't be with the full orchestra just yet, but this will be a stepping stone to kind of get us toward that full movement and also hopefully be able to take this to other cities as well.
And Silas House is involved?
Yes. Dear friend, Silas, he's going to be opening the night. He's got a incredible new book that is out. And so he's going to be reading some passages from that book to kind of open the night and welcome everyone. So it's a very exciting time.
I know that you know that rehearsals are kind of a thing in and of themselves, almost apart from the performance that they're preparing for. I wonder if you could take us back to that very first time when you heard what you had created coming out of those orchestral instruments.
It took my breath away. As a self-taught musician who I don't read music. I don't know anything other than what I have had to learn on my own. I never went to school for music. And to hear these classically trained players begin the very first notes, and I just was overwhelmed and I had chills, and it was almost like a dream where I was out of my own body experiencing this. And to have such a caliper and a quality of musicianship to be put to my songs was something I'll never forget, truly.
And I mentioned in the introduction that there are three things, actually, we wanted to bring up that you've been involved in lately. And another is that your music, you, are featured in the Steve Zahn film, Steve and Audrey Zahn film, I should say, She Dances,
yes,
which was just screened in the 12 Lions Film Festival in Lexington. I saw your credit, and I thought, I've got to ask her about that. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so my original song, Undercover, is featured in the film a few times throughout. I am also singing on the main theme of the movie, as well as singing at the credits. So you'll hear my voice kind of sprinkled throughout the film.
That's Bea Taylor. She's at Castle and Key with the Lexington Ballet on October 16th, with members of Lexville at the Downtown Arts Center in Lexington on October 24th. Good luck, Bea.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep On, Keepin' On is a collection of music celebrating the life and impact that Bobby Osborne, born in Thousand Sticks, Kentucky, near Hyden, has had on the past, present, and future of bluegrass music. This is, after all, the voice of Rocky Top, arguably the most well-known bluegrass song of all time. Bobby Osborne died on June 27, 2023, at the age of 91. This tribute was organized and co-produced by C.J. Lewandowski. He's the founder of the Poor Ramblin' Boys, among the winners of the International Bluegrass Music Association's New Artist of the Year Award. And he's here with us. Welcome, C.J.
Well, thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
I know it's a long and truly wonderful story and may be difficult to squeeze into a nutshell, but if you could attempt to do that, given our time limitation, tell us about your relationship with Bobby Osborne.
I met Bobby, I guess I was 15 when I met him the first time and just got my picture with him, and that's how it started. And then years later, I was with the Carl Shivlett and Big Country show, and we were traveling a lot and playing the same places as Bobby with his Rocky Top Express. And so I got to hang out with him and be kind of friends with him backstage. But I guess 2017, I bought a mandolin that was around the same time period as Bobby's. And so that was the time when we decided that we were going to hang out a little bit more because he was very interested in that mandolin. So took it to his house, and we had a really good time. And that's when I started going at least once a month to Bobby's house in Tennessee there. And we just shared a love of mandolins, and then it just kept going and going and going. And long story short, 2 days before he passed away, he told his daughter, Tina, that I was his best friend. Wow. And I considered Bobby a huge mentor and an amazing friend, but I would have never thought that he would have, you know, said that I was his best friend. But that's something that all the Grammys and Grand Ole Opry appearances, they can't ever replace. So he was not only a bluegrass legend and a country music artist and a musical mentor to me, but there was a lot of conversations that we had that meant a lot, you know, kind of a grandfather figure.
Mm-hmm. Well, CJ, by the time you recorded this album, Bobby was 91. Tell us about that studio experience.
I mean, a studio experience for those who have been in one is usually very organized. And we have a plan, we have charts, we have harmony, we have all that stuff already planned out. The main purpose of finding a studio and all this stuff and the people that were on the record as well was to make Bobby feel comfortable. This was a time that Bobby wasn't feeling real good about himself. And that was the whole reason that we started this album as well, to expand his creativity, just to help him feel good and do something. He was really down and out about not playing the Opry as much and small things, not playing the shows that he used to. And it wasn't because that people didn't want him to. It was just a time when we were all trying to figure out if we needed to bring some of these older folks back on stage again after the pandemic. And the pandemic was very hard on Bobby. And so this studio experience was all about Bobby being comfortable. And we would think of songs that are on that album. We would think of them that day, and we would put them down. So it was really impromptu, but it was Bobby calling the shots again. And that's what we wanted. The experience, it's unlike any other that I've ever had in the studio, just because I was sitting there. You know, some days we would go in and there wouldn't be one song recorded. It was just like story time with Bobby. And that was fine. You know?
Well, you know, that version of Rocky Top that we sampled during the introduction, that featured Bobby on lead vocals, right? And that had to be a really special moment, I would think.
That is, you know, Bobby, a short story here. Bobby, that's one of those songs that was impromptu. Bobby said, you know, we ought to do Rocky Top. And I said, Bobby, the original is the best thing that's ever been, you know, probably arguably one of the most the most popular bluegrass song of all time. I was like, man, I don't know if we should touch that. And I said, I know it's you and Sonny, but I don't know if we should touch that. And he said, well, I'd like to do it again. I said, okay, what key? And that kind of ticked him off because, you know, he did it in B originally. And I guess he thought that I didn't think that he could do it. I just wanted to know. And so that kind of put a little fire under him. And we got in there and cut it. And he was in a booth that couldn't see all the band, but the band was all in one big room with a little bit of separation. And so we could make eye contact with one another, but Bobby couldn't see us. And I guess Bobby didn't know that his mic was on. So he was kind of talking to himself, and he said, well, he said, this will probably be the last time I ever record this one. And everyone in the studio band just about fell apart.
Wow.
We couldn't believe what we were hearing. And then
it was towards the end of the day. He was a little scratchy. And so he said, I'd like to come in and re-sing it. Lo and behold, Rocky Top is the very last song that Bobby ever sang in the studio. That vocal that you hear on that recording is 3 weeks before he passed away. You know, kind of a full circle thing, a song that brought him to his highest peak, and the song that he made popular is the last one, the closing of the door, you know?
Well, when he passed in 23, there was a New York Times article about him. It was a tribute that said the band that he led with his brother Sonny broke new ground with, as they put it, an unusually broad repertoire, unorthodox instrumentation, and untraditional vocal harmonies. Is that an accurate description? What do you think they meant by all that?
You know, I think that the New York Times is along the lines of being pretty correct. We can say that because in 1939, Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys, when they hit the stage of the Grand Ole Opry, it was unorthodox, and it was wild, and it was crazy. And then in 1946, Bill Monroe and Lester Flatt, they hit the stage with Bill Monroe, and there's another ungodly thing that they've never seen before. They're playing in different key, higher keys. The five-string banjo is being played with that three-finger roll that's never been seen before. So to say that some of this is unorthodox and, you know, instrumentation never heard before, I think, you know, both Sonny and Bobby were extremely innovative in their instrument, and they were also extremely innovative in the vocal range. You know, the first ever of this harmony stack, a trio kind of started with bluegrass, you know. You have your tenor, your lead in the middle, and the baritone on the bottom. Well, they moved the lead up to a high lead, brought that baritone up underneath of it, and then took the tenor and made a low tenor, which was a harmony structure that had never happened before. And, you know, Bobby told the story of figuring out once more the song with Red Allen, and that was the song. And he said, we figured out that harmony, and he said, we were coming back to Cincinnati, and he said, we sang that song the whole way home because we were so afraid that we were going to forget how we were singing it. So he said they sang it the whole way home. And, you know, it was more of a feature of Bobby, like, adapt to the situation that you're in. And another thing, too, is festivals, when they started, was not a thing. So they're trying to play clubs. They're trying to play anywhere they can, really. And so another story that Bobby told, speaking of the instrumentation, was him and Dale Sledd and Sonny were playing these clubs. Well, eventually they started opening up for these country acts and whatnot, and started going out with Merle Haggard and traveling. And he said, no matter what we did, three boys gathered around one microphone wasn't cutting it to the crowds that Merle Haggard and the Strangers were pulling in. He said, so we had to figure out a way to reach these audiences. So he said that day we went to the music store, we got pickups put on our instruments, and that's when it all changed. And I would call it innovative, but I would also call it just plain and simple adaptation, you know?
Yeah, rolling with the times.
Yeah.
So, CJ, I'm wondering what in your mind is the Bobby Osborne legacy that you and he would like people to remember?
I think my definition of Bobby's legacy may be a little bit different than his, but I'm going to touch on his for sure. I was watching an interview with him at the Grand Ole Opry one day, and somebody asked along the lines of this same question. And he said, I just want to be known for being a great entertainer, being a Grand Ole Opry member, being the best that I could be at what I did. And, you know, another thing about Bobby was he wants to be on that stage, and he wants to play, and he wants to sing till the day he can't. And this album, Keep On Keeping On, is kind of the last page of his story. And he literally played and sang almost all the way up to the end. And, you know, to be the person that kind of bears that torch was a lot to bear for a minute. But, you know, after hearing it all together and people's comments and all that stuff, I feel like we tried to do him justice. And his legacy, I don't have to do anything because the Osborne brothers and the legacy of Bobby
is never going to tire. And I can honestly say that that is a fact, because look at this album. We have half of the people that are on it, over 25 people on the album. Half of them are under the age of 40. At the time of the recording, we had a range from 13 years old to 91.
Wow.
So look at the generation span that Bobby Osborne has influenced alive. And, I hope this album keeps Bobby's name relevant. And I don't think we're at a loss of that ever, but I hope if somebody likes the Poor Ramblin' Boys or Jaylee Roberts or Sam Bush or Billy Strings, who's on this album, or the McCurries, they might find this song because of that relation and maybe become a fan of Bobby because they've never heard of him before.
What a story. This is just fantastic, and we really appreciate you sharing it with us. I wish we had a lot more time, CJ. We've run out of it, but we'll play some music going out from the album. This is C.J. Lewandowski, co-producer of Keep On Keepin' On, a collection of songs celebrating the music and life of Bobby Osborne. Thanks so much, C.J.
Thank you very much.
Rocky Top, Tennessee. Once two strangers climbed old Rocky Top looking for a moonshine still. Strangers ain't come down from Rocky Top, reckon they never will. Corn won't grow at all on Rocky Top, dirt's too rocky by far. That's why all the folks on Rocky Top get their corn from a jar. Rocky Top, you'll always be home sweet home to me. Good old Rocky Top, Rocky Top, Tennessee. Rocky Top, Tennessee.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interviews. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. And just a reminder, if you have a question about something that you would like for us to look into, record it on your phone and email that MP3 to es@eku.edu with your name and town. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.